A Treatise on Keeping the Heart by John Flavel, a 17th century Puritan preacher. Copyright 2009 Hail and Fire. This audiobook, a 2009 edition, is provided free of charge by the Hail and Fire online library www.hailandfire.com for all non-profit, personal uses and distributions. This audiobook is composed of a public domain text. This audiobook is not licensed for republication in any form without prior written consent from Hail and Fire. However, a URL link to the Hail and Fire library may be published in order to encourage downloading of this audiobook. Begin audiobook. Keeping the Heart by John Flavel, 1813 edition. Hail and Fire reprints 2009. Keep thy heart with all diligence, for out of it are the issues of life. Proverbs 4:23. The heart of man is his worst part before it be regenerated, and the best afterwards. It is the seat of principles, and the fountain of actions. The eye of God is, and the eye of the Christian ought to be, principally fixed upon it. The greatest difficulty in conversion is to win the heart to God, and the greatest difficulty after conversion is to keep the heart with God. Here lies the very force and stress of religion. Here is that which makes the way to life a narrow way, and the gate of heaven a straight gate. Direction and help in this great work are the spoke and run of the text, wherein we have 1. An exhortation: keep thy heart with all diligence. 2. The reason or motive enforcing it, for out of it are the issues of life. In the exhortation I shall consider, first, the matter of the duty. Secondly, the manner of performing it. 1. The matter of the duty: keep thy heart. Heart is not here taken properly, for that noble part of the body, which philosophers call the first that lives, and the last that dies, but by heart, in a metaphor, the scripture sometimes understands some particular noble faculty of the soul. In Romans 1:21 it is put: for the understanding part, their foolish heart, that is, their foolish understanding was darkened. Psalm 119:11, it is put: for the memory, thy word have I hid in my heart, and 1 John 3:10, it is put: for the conscience, which has in it both the light of the understanding and the recognitions of the memory. If our heart condemn us, that is, if our conscience, whose proper office it is to condemn. But here we are to take it more generally, for the whole soul, or inner man. What the heart is to the body, that the soul is to the man, and what health is to the heart, that holiness is to the soul. The state of the whole body depends upon the soundness and vigor of the heart, and the everlasting state of the whole man upon the good or ill condition of the soul. By keeping the heart, understand the diligent and constant use of all holy means to preserve the soul from sin, and maintain its sweet and free communion with God. I say constant, for the reason added in the text extends the duty to all the states and conditions of a Christian's life, and makes it binding always. If the heart must be kept, because out of it are the issues of life, then as long as these issues of life do flow out of it, we are obliged to keep it. Later on the text, we'll have the word taken from a besieged garrison, beset by many enemies without, and in danger of being betrayed by treacherous citizens within, in which danger the soldiers, upon pain of death, are commanded to watch, and though the expression, keep thy heart, seems to put it upon us as our work, yet it does not imply a sufficiency in us to do it. We are as able to stop the sun in its course, or to make the rivers run backward, as by our own skill and power to rule and order our hearts. We may as well be our own saviors as our own keepers, and yet Solomon speaks properly enough when he says, "Keep thy heart, because the duty is ours, though the power be God's." A natural man has no power, a gracious man has some, though not sufficient, and what power he has depends upon the exciting and assisting strength of Christ. Grace within us is beholden to grace without us. Without me ye can do nothing, John 15:5. So much of the matter of the duty. 2. The manner of performing it is with all diligence. The Hebrew is very emphatical, keep with all keeping, or keep, set double guards, your hearts will be gone else. This vehemency of expression with which the duty is urged plainly implies how difficult it is to keep our hearts, how dangerous to let them go. The reason or motive quickening to this duty is very forcible and weighty, for out of the heart are the issues of life. That is, the heart is the source of all vital operations. It is the spring and original both of good and evil, as the spring in a watch that sets all the wheels in motion. The heart is the treasury, the hand and tongue, but the shops, what is in these, comes from that. The hand and tongue always begin where the heart ends. The heart contrives, and the members execute. A good man out of the good treasure of his heart bringeth forth that which is good, and an evil man out of the evil treasure of his heart bringeth forth that which is evil, for of the abundance of the heart his mouth speaketh, Luke 6:45. So then, if the heart errs in its work, these must miscarry in theirs, for heart errors are like the errors of the first concoction, which cannot be rectified afterwards, or like the misplacing and inverting of the stamps and letters in the press, which must cause so many errata in all the copies that are printed. Oh, then how important a duty is that which is contained in the following proposition. The keeping and right managing of the heart in every condition is the great business of a Christian's life. What the philosopher says of waters is as properly applicable to hearts. It is hard to keep them within any bounds. God has set limits to them, yet how frequently do they transgress not only the bounds of grace and religion, but even of reason and common honesty? This is that which affords the Christian matter of labor, fear and trembling, to his dying day. It is not the cleansing of the hand that makes the Christian, for many a hypocrite can show as fair a hand as he, but the purifying, watching and right ordering of the heart. This is the thing that provokes so many sad complaints, and costs so many deep groans and tears. It was the pride of Hezekiah's heart that made him lie in the dust, mourning before the Lord, 2 Chronicles 30-26. It was the fear of hypocrisies invading the heart that made David cry, "Let my heart be sound in my statutes, that I be not ashamed," Psalm 119:80. It was the sad experience he had of the divisions and distractions of his own heart in the service of God that made him pour out the prayer, "Unite my heart to fear thy name," Psalm 86:11. The method in which I propose to improve the proposition is this. First, I shall inquire what the keeping of the heart supposes and imports. Secondly, assign divers reasons why Christians must make this the great business of their lives. Thirdly, Point out those seasons which especially call for this diligence in keeping the heart. Fourthly, apply the whole. First, I am to consider what the keeping of the heart supposes and imports. To keep the heart necessarily supposes a previous work of sanctification, which has set the heart right, by giving it a new spiritual inclination, for as long as the heart is not set right by grace, as to its habitual frame, no means can keep it right with God. Self is the poise of the unsanctified heart, which biases and moves it in all its designs and actions, and as long as it is so, it is impossible that any external means should keep it with God. Man, by creation, was of one constant, uniform frame of spirit, held one straight and even course, not one thought or faculty was disordered, his mind had a perfect knowledge of the requirements of God, his will a perfect compliance therewith, all his appetites and powers stood in a most obedient subordination. Man, by degeneration, is become a most disordered and rebellious creature, opposing his Maker, as the first cause, by self-dependence, as the chief good, by self-love, as the highest Lord, by self-will, and as the last end, by self-seeking. Thus he is quite disordered, and all his actions are irregular. His once illuminated understanding is now clouded with ignorance, his once complying will is now full of rebellion and stubbornness, his once subordinate powers have now cast off the dominion of superior faculties. But by regeneration this disordered soul is set right again, sanctification being, as the scripture expresses it, Ephesians 4:24, the renovation of the soul after the image of God, in which self-dependence is removed by faith, self-love, by the love of God, self-will, by subjection and obedience to the will of God, and self-seeking, by self-denial. The darkened understanding is again illuminated, Ephesians 1:18, the refractory will sweetly subdued, Psalm 110:8, the rebellious appetite gradually conquered, Romans 6:7. Thus the soul, which sin had universally depraved, is by grace restored. This being presupposed, it will not be difficult to apprehend what it is to keep the heart, which is nothing but the constant care and diligence of such a renewed man, to preserve his soul in that holy frame to which grace has raised it. For, though grace has in a great measure rectified the soul and given it an habitual heavenly temper, yet sin often actually discomposes it again, so that even a gracious heart is like a musical instrument, which, though it be exactly tuned, a small matter brings out of tune again, yea, hang it aside but a little and it will need setting again before another lesson can be played upon it. If gracious hearts are in a desirable frame in one duty, yet how dull, dead, and disordered, when they come to another. Therefore every duty needs a particular preparation of the heart. If thou prepare thine heart and stretch out thine hands toward him, Job 11:13, etc. To keep the heart then, is carefully to preserve it from sin which disorders it, and maintain that spiritual and gracious frame, which fits it for a life of communion with God. This includes in it six particulars. 1. Frequent observation of the frame of the heart. Carnal and formal persons take no heed to this, they cannot be brought to concur with their own hearts. There are some people who have lived 40 or 50 years in the world and have had scarcely 1 hour's discourse with their own hearts. It is a hard thing to bring a man and himself together upon such business, but Saint know those soliloquies to be very salutary. The heathen could say, the soul is made wise by sitting still in quietness. Though the bankrupt care not to look into their books of accounts, yet upright hearts will know, whether they go backward or forward. I commune with mine own heart, says David, Psalm 127:6. The heart can never be kept, until its case be examined and understood. 3. It includes deep humiliation for hard evils and disorders. Thus Hezekiah humbled himself for the pride of his heart, 2 Chronicles 30-26. Thus the people were ordered to spread forth their hands to God in prayer, realizing the plague of their own hearts, 1 Kings 8:38. Upon this account many an upright heart has been laid low before God. Oh, what in heart have I? Saints have in their confessions pointed at the heart, the pain place, Lord, here is the wound. It is with the heart well kept, as it is with the eye. If a small particle of dust gets into the eye, it will never cease blinking and watering till it has wept it out. So the upright heart cannot be at rest till it has wept out its troubles and poured out its complaints before the Lord. 3. It includes earnest supplication and instant prayer for purifying and rectifying grace, when sin has defiled and disordered the heart. Cleanse thou me from secret faults, Psalm 30:12. Unite my heart to fear thy name, Psalm 136:11. Saints have always many such petitions depending before the throne of God's grace. This is the thing which is most pleaded by them with God. When they are praying for outward mercies, perhaps their spirits may be more remiss, but when it comes to the heart's ease, they extend their spirits to the utmost, fill their mouths with arguments, weak and make supplication. Oh, for a better heart! Oh, for a heart to love God more, to hate sin more, to walk more evenly with God. Lord, deny not to me such a heart. Whatever thou deny me, give me a heart to fear thee, to love and delight in thee, if I beg my bread in desolate places. It is observed of an eminent saint, that, when he was confessing sin, he would never give over confessing, until he had felt some brokenness of heart for that sin, and when praying for any spiritual mercy, would never give over that suit, till he had obtained some relish of that mercy. 4. It includes the imposing of strong engagements upon ourselves to walk more carefully with God, and avoid the occasions whereby the heart may be induced to sin. Well-advised and deliberate vows are, in some cases, very useful to guard the heart against some special sin. I have made a covenant with mine eyes, says Job, Job 31:1. By this means holy men have overawed their souls and preserved themselves from defilement by some special heart corrections. 5. It includes a constant and holy jealousy over our own hearts. Quick-sighted self-jealousy is an excellent preservative from sin. He that will keep his heart must have the eyes of his soul awake and open upon all the disorderly and tumultuous stirrings of his affections. If the affections break loose and the passions be stirred, the soul must discover it and suppress them, before they get to a height. O my soul, dost thou well in this? My tumultuous thoughts and passions, where is your commission? Happy is the man that thus feareth always, Proverbs 28:14. By this fear of the Lord it is that men depart from evil, shake off security and preserve themselves from iniquity. He that will keep his heart must eat and drink with fear, 1 Corinthians 10:31, rejoice with fear, Psalm 2:11, and pass the whole time of his sojourning here in fear. 1 Peter 1:17. All this is little enough to keep the heart from sin. 6. It includes the realizing of God's presence with us and setting the Lord always before us. This the people of God have found a powerful means of keeping their hearts upright and awing them from sin. When the eye of our faith is fixed upon the eye of God's omniscience, we dare not let out our thoughts and affections to vanity. Holy Job dared not suffer his heart to yield to an impure, vain thought, and what was it that moved him to so great circumspection? He tells us, "Doth not he see my ways, and count all my steps?" Job 31. In such particulars as these, do gracious souls express the care they have of their hearts. They are careful to prevent the breaking loose of their corruptions in times of temptation, careful to preserve the sweetness and comfort they have got from God in any duty. This is the work, and of all works in religion it is the most difficult, constant, and important work. 1. It is the hardest work. Hard work is hard work indeed. To shuffle over religious duties with a loose and heedless spirit will cost no great pains. But to set yourself before the Lord and tie up your loose and vain thoughts to a constant and serious attendance upon Him, this will cost you something. To attain a facility and dexterity of language in prayer and put your meaning into apt and decent expressions is easy, but to get your heart broken for sin, while you are confessing it, melted with free grace, while you are blessing God for it, to be really ashamed and humbled through the apprehensions of God's infinite holiness, and to keep your heart in this frame, not only in but after duty, will surely cost you some groans and pains of soul. To repress the outward acts of sin and compose the external part of your life in a laudable manner is no great matter. Even carnal persons by the force of common principles can do this, but to kill the root of corruption within, to set and keep up an holy government over your thoughts, to have all things lie straight and orderly in the heart, this is not easy. 2. It is a constant work. The keeping of the heart is a work that is never done till life be ended. There is no time or condition in the life of a Christian which will suffer an intermission of this work. It is in keeping watch over our hearts, as it was in keeping out Moses' hands, while Israel and Amalek were fighting. Exodus 17:12. No sooner do the hands of Moses grow heavy and sink down, than Amalek prevails. Intermitting the watch over their own heads, for but a few minutes, cost David and Peter many a sad day and night. 3. It is the most important business of a Christian's life. Without this we are but formalists in religion. All our professions, gifts, and duties signify nothing. "My son, give me thine heart," is God's request, Proverbs 23:26. God is pleased to call that a gift, which is indeed a debt. He will put this honor upon the creature, to receive it from him in the way of a gift, but if this be not given him, he regards not whatever else you bring to him. There is only so much of worth in what we do, as there is of heart in it. Concerning the heart, God seems to say, as Joseph of Benjamin, "If you bring not Benjamin with you, you shall not see my face." Among the heathen, when the beast was cut up for sacrifice, the first thing the priest looked upon was the heart. And if that was unsound and worthless, the sacrifice was rejected. God rejects all duties, how glorious soever in other respects, which are offered him without a heart. He that performs duty without a heart, that is, heedlessly, is no more accepted with God than he that performs it with a double heart, that is, hypocritically, Isaiah 66:3. Thus I have briefly considered what the keeping of the heart supposes and imports. I proceed, secondly, to assign divers reasons why Christians must make this the great business of their lives. The importance and necessity of making this our great business will manifestly appear from several considerations. 4. The glory of God is much concerned. Heart evils are very provoking evils to the Lord. The schools correctly observe that outward sins are sins of great infamy, but that heart sins are sins of deeper guilt. How severely has the great God declared his wrath from heaven against heart wickedness! The great crime for which the old world stands indicted is heart wickedness. God saw that every imagination of their hearts was only evil and that continually, Genesis 6:5-7, for which he sent the most dreadful judgment that was ever executed since time began. We find not their murders, adulteries, blasphemies, though they were defiled with these particularly alleged against them, but the evils of their hearts. That by which God was so provoked as to give up his peculiar inheritance into the enemy's hand was the evil of their hearts. O Jerusalem, wash thine heart from wickedness, that thou mayest be saved. How long shall thy vain thoughts lodge within thee? Jeremiah 4:14. Of the wickedness and vanity of their thoughts, God took particular notice, and because of this, the Chaldeans must come upon them, as a lion from his thicket, and tear them to pieces, Jeremiah 4:7. For the sin of thoughts it was that God threw down the fallen angels from heaven and still keeps them in everlasting chains to the judgment of the great day, by which expression is not obscurely intimated some extraordinary judgment to which they are reserved, as prisoners that have most irons laid upon them may be supposed to be the greatest malefactors. And what was their sin? Spiritual wickedness. Merely heart evils are so provoking to God that for them he rejects with indignation all the duties that some men perform unto him. He that killeth an ox is as if he slew a man, he that sacrificeth a lamb as if he cut off a dog's neck, he that offereth an oblation as if he offered swine's blood, he that burneth incense as if he blessed an idol, Isaiah 66:3. In what words could the abhorrence of a creature's actions be more fully expressed by the holy God? Murder and idolatry are not more vile in his account than their sacrifices, though materially such as himself appointed. And what made their sacrifices so vile? The following words inform us their soul delighteth in their abominations, Isaiah 66:3. Such is the vileness of mere heart sins that the scriptures sometimes intimate the difficulty of pardon for them. The heart of Simon Magus was not right, he had base thoughts of God and of the things of God. The apostle bade him repent and pray, if perhaps the thoughts of his heart might be forgiven him. Acts 8:21. Oh then never slight heart evils, for by these God is highly wronged and provoked. For this reason let every Christian make it his work to keep his heart with all diligence. 2. The sincerity of our profession much depends upon the care we exercise in keeping our hearts. Most certainly that man who is careless of the frame of his heart is but a hypocrite in his profession, however eminent he be in the externals of religion. We have a striking instance of this in the history of Jehu. But Jehu took no heed to walk in the ways of the Lord God of Israel with his heart. 2 Kings 10:31. The context gives an account of the great service performed by Jehu against the house of Ahab and Baal, and also of the great temporal reward given him by God for that service, even that his children to the fourth generation should sit upon the throne of Israel. Yet in these words Jehu is censured for a hypocrite. Though God approved and rewarded the work, yet he abhorred and rejected the person that did it, as hypocritical. Wherein lay the hypocrisy of Jehu? In this he took no heed to walk in the ways of the Lord with his heart, that is, he did all insincerely and for selfish ends, and though the work he did was materially good, yet he, not purging his heart from those unworthy selfish designs in doing it, was a hypocrite. And though Simon Magus appeared such a person that the apostle could not regularly reject him, yet his hypocrisy was quickly discovered. Though he professed piety and associated himself with the saints, he was a stranger to the mortification of heart sins. Thy heart is not right with God, Acts 8:21. It is true, there is great difference between Christians themselves in their diligence and dexterity about heart work. Some are more conversant with and more successful in it than others, but he that takes no heed to his heart, that is not careful to order it aright before God, is but a hypocrite. And they come unto thee, as the people cometh, and they sit before thee as my people, and they hear thy words, but they will not do them, for with their mouth they so much love, but their heart goeth after their covetousness. Ezekiel 33:31. Here was a company of formal hypocrites, as is evident from that expression, as my people, like them, but not of them. And what made them so? Their outside was fair, here were reverent postures, high professions, much seeming delight in ordinances, thou art to them as a lovely psalm, yea, but for all that, they kept not their hearts with God in those duties, their hearts were commanded by their lusts, they went after their covetousness. Had they kept their hearts with God, all had been well, but not regarding which way their hearts went in duty, there lay the essence of their hypocrisy. If any upright soul should hence infer, I am a hypocrite too, for many times my heart departs from God in duty, do what I can, yet I cannot hold it close with God. I answer, the very objection carries in it its own solution. You say, do what I can, yet I cannot keep my heart with God. Soul, if you do what you can, you have the blessing of an upright, though God sees good to exercise you under the affliction of a discomposed heart. There still remains some wildness in the thoughts and fancies of the best, to humble them, but if you find a care before to prevent them and opposition against them, when they come, and grief and sorrow afterwards, you find enough to clear you from the charge of reigning hypocrisy. This precaution is seen partly in laying up the word in your heart, to prevent them. Thy word have I hid in mine heart, that I might not sin against thee, Psalm 119:11. Partly in your endeavors to engage your heart to God, Jeremiah 30:21. And partly in begging preventing grace from God, in your commencement of duty, Psalm 119:36-37. It is a good sign to exercise such precaution. And it is an evidence of uprightness, to oppose these sins in their first rise. I hate vain thoughts, Psalm 119:113. The spirit lusteth against the flesh. Galatians 5:4. Thy grief also discovers the uprightness of your heart. If with Hezekiah you are humbled for the evils of your heart, you have no reason, from those disorders, to question the integrity of it, but to suffer sin to lodge quietly in the heart, to let thy heart habitually and uncontrollably wander from God, is a sad, a dangerous symptom indeed. 3. The beauty of our conversation arises from the heavenly frame of our spirits. There is a spiritual luster and beauty in the conversation of saints. The righteous is more excellent than his neighbor, Proverbs 12:26. Saints shine as the lights of the world. But whatever luster and beauty is in their lives comes from the excellency of their spirits, as the candle within puts luster upon the lantern in which it shines. It is impossible that a disordered and neglected heart should ever produce well-ordered conversation, and since, as the text observes, the issues or streams of life flow out of the heart as their fountain, it must follow that such as the heart is, the life will be. Hence, 1 Peter 2:12, abstain from fleshly lusts, having your conversation honest, or beautiful, as the Greek word imports. So Isaiah 4:7, let the wicked forsake his way, and the unrighteous man his thoughts. His way denotes the course of his life, his thoughts, the frame of his heart, and therefore, since the course of his life flows from his thoughts or the frame of his heart, both, or neither will he forsaken. The heart is the source of all actions. These actions are virtually and radically contained in our thoughts. These thoughts, being once made up into affections, are quickly made out into suitable actions. If the heart be wicked, then, as Christ says, Matthew 15:40, out of the heart proceed evil thoughts, murders, etc. Mark the order: first, wanton or revengeful thoughts, then unclean, or murderous practices. And if the heart be holy, then it is as with David. My heart is inditing a good matter, I speak of the things which I have made. My tongue is as the pen of a ready writer, Psalm 45:1. Here is a life richly beautified with good works, summary made. I will speak of the things which I have made, others making. My heart is indicting, both proceed from the heavenly frame of his heart. Put the heart in frame and the life will quickly discover that it is so. It is not very difficult to discern, by the performances and converse of Christians, what frames their spirits are in.